Today's next step is sponsored by Predator Cycling, specializing in custom carbon bicycles, components, accessories, and repair. Pushing the limits of technology, derived from experience, created from passion, fabricated by cyclists for cyclists. Predator Cycling. Visit them at predatorcycling.com. The bright young lady Tigrana stops on her way to Uganda for a conversation and some coffee. Also, we'll be looking at technology and why we're not exploiting it the way we should. This is Father Voskin, and I'm connecting the dots between the physical, the emotional, the spiritual, and I'm inviting you to do it with us. This is episode number 432 of The Next Step.
Hi, this is Susie from In His Shoes, welcoming you to our ninth year of broadcasting The Next Step. The next step is a step, a stride, moving us forward. Here, Father Voskin provides his unique and distinctive voice for Armenian Orthodoxy, giving an intelligent and practical answer to the challenges of life, based on the solid principles of love, faith, and hope as expressed by Jesus Christ. It's a practical approach to melding spirit and passion in the real world. The next steps are serious, fun, informative, and most of all relevant, as religion should be. So get ready. We're taking the next step.
When you decide what the future is, you want to get there as soon as you can. You agree with that? When you decide what the future is, that's from Apple CEO Tim Cook. A couple days ago, after the unveiling of the new iPhones, he had an interview on one of the networks, I believe it was in ABC. And they asked him about why there's no headphone jack in the new iPhone. And he said, well, wireless is the future. And when you decide what the future is, you want to get there as soon as you can. What do you think? Oh, you know me. Yeah, I'm going to make that connection. Connection with our church, too, you know. With the Armenian Orthodox Church, with the Armenian Orthodox tradition. When you know what the future is, why would you hesitate? Why would you go slower to get there? Nostalgia? Well, let's talk about that right now. But before that, hey, welcome. Glad you're with us today. Got a good show for you today. We are going to be catching up with Tigrana Zakharyan. Yes, you do remember. Yes, of course. Last year, we had a chance to do a project with her in Glendale on the 100th anniversary of the Armenian Genocide commemoration. It was pretty cool because it went beyond Armenian Genocide. We talked with other people. We were part of a panel with people who had experienced genocide. And as she so eloquently explained this morning when I had a chance to share a conversation with her over some coffee, she said that, if we want to admit that we are the first genocide of the 20th century, that means that there are other genocides. There have been other genocides. Yes, wake up call. Anyway, we're going to be talking about that coming up in the second portion of today's show. But let's go on to this topic. Why am I bringing up Tim Cook? Yeah, you know, I'm not that big. Yes, born and raised in Cupertino. I was there when Apple became Apple. Yes, it used to be apple orchards, actually apricot orchards. And back in the 80s, I remember when Apple just started out. And, did we love those Apple computers and those Macintoshes. And now we love our iPhones. And I have to tell you, honestly, I sold out a few months ago, strictly for utilitarian reasons. Yeah, I was a diehard Android fan. I love the flexibility, the use of the Android system, the ability to customize the way you want without Big Brother Apple looking over your shoulder. But in the end, I gave in just a couple months ago. I was on a call, a very important call, actually. Can't tell you who it was, because then you'd say, this man's name dropping, and I don't want you to do that. But I was on a very important call when my battery ran out. I go, what? I mean, if nothing else, with all of these gizmos that you got on smartphones, the one thing a phone should do is what? Make a phone call. And I had a string of just one phone call after the other hanging up on me because my battery wouldn't last more than a few hours. And I went after AT&T. I said, hey, what is this? Well, this is part of the Android dilemma. Yes, you have to walk around with little plugs and everything. So finally got into iPhone. And I have to tell you, I'm not unhappy. I am unhappy that there's this control element that Apple has, but they've always had that. But hey, when you've got a battery life that you, yeah, I mean, to me, a phone should, you should wake up in the morning, use it, and at night you should charge it. That's it, right? None of this, like during the middle of the day, sticking it into cigarette lighters and little battery packs and moon packs, whatever you got. Anyway, last week, Apple unveiled its iPhone 7. And following that, and you know, whenever Apple unveils something, there's a lot of hoopla around it. And so there's number two strike against it, right? You know what I feel about hoopla, too. Anyway, they unveiled their phone, and lo and behold, there is no earphone jack. So a couple days later, I believe it was on ABC, and I'll definitely have the link on today's show notes, so do check it out. I'll have the exact quote, whatever it was. But Tim Cook, the CEO of Apple, was being interviewed, and he said wireless is the way of the future, or is the future. Then he said something very important. He said, when you decide what the future is, you want to get there as soon as you can. And that just reverberated in me. That is so true. If you know what's ahead, why would you hesitate? Well, one of the reasons for big hesitation, right, is nostalgia. Yeah, we like those warm, fuzzy feelings. In fact, a lot of us do it. A lot of us that, you know, were around at the time of the dinosaurs and the cavemen and everything, we look back on that simple life. In fact, the other day I was in an old hotel, one of these giant hotels, you know, like I believe it was the Hilton, or they call it something else. It was Renaissance. Anyway, I had gone in to use their parking, and I was on traveling and everything. So I had parked there, and I had walked through the lobby, and there was a string of these little booths. And if you didn't know about telephones, you wouldn't know why they were there. You might, if you religiously, you might even think they were confessionals. They were like little booths where telephones used to be. And I went down this line, and there were no telephones. Now, believe it or not, back in the old days, yeah, there used to be this telephone that would be there on the street corner. And you'd go up, and for a dime, now, yeah, I'm not going to date myself too far back. For a dime, you stuck it in there, and it would make a nice little jingle noise. And then you would dial, not punch, you would dial a number. And that was what a telephone conversation was. And there is a nostalgia about that. There is a simplicity of life. Hey, why are some of these old shows? Do you know that on TV you can watch basically the 60s and 70s, the shows from the 60s and 70s, on a wide variety of television? Before it used to be, what was it, Nickelodeon, then it became TV Land. Now there is MeTV, there's Cozy TV, there's Retro TV, and decades, whoa, fantastic stuff, right? It's all stuff from the past, nostalgia. Yeah, there is a nice feeling, there's a warmth, and there is a comfort zone in living in the past. But what does it get you? Nothing. Really, I mean, think about it. That comfort zone is nice. But what does it get you? It doesn't allow you to interact with the reality of today. It's almost like you go into a little corner over there and you live in a separate reality. So when Tim Cook says something like this, it reverberates in me. Why? Because it's a challenge, really. It's a challenge that we all have. You know, we talk a lot, especially in Christianity, about the idea of forgiveness. And you know, that's a hot topic over here at In His Shoes, because what we do is we talk a lot about forgiveness on not only a personal level, but on a global scale. In other words, can we find new dialogues? Can we find new metaphors? Can we find new ways of expressing ourselves? Or does everything mean that, you know, hey, if there is a conflict, the only way you can solve it is by being more powerful than the other guy? Guess what? That rhetoric is well and alive, and it's being rekindled today. That there is peace through might. Can we think of different metaphors? Can we start saying that instead of fighting fire with fire, I'm going to fight it with water? No, that's too logical, isn't it? Yeah, there's a fire. I'm going to put some water on it. There is hatred over there. I'm going to combat it with love. Now, that's completely illogical, but it's something that hasn't been tried. And perhaps if we do try these new metaphors, we will find that they aren't as illogical as you may think. In fact, it is the same formula as fighting fire with water, as to fight hatred with love. To overcome the most difficult with one of the most easy feelings that we all possess. To lighten the darkness with a small bit of light. The light that's inside of you. That's what the Christian is challenged to do every single day of his life. That's what you're challenged to do. That's what Armenian Orthodoxy is about. Armodoxy, as we call it. Strip it out from all of the hoopla, all of the ornamentation. Go down to the basic structure of what we believe. The oldest Christian tradition ties in with Christianity. At the very basic level. I'm not talking about 2,000 years ago. I'm talking about from the beginning of time, beginning of universe. And whatever your tradition may be, you understand that something happened at the beginning. Whether you believe that's a creator, or whether you believe that there is no creator and it's just a big bang. But somehow we know that we have evolved. We have arrived here because of a set of circumstances that have existed in our life. You don't have to go back 13 billion years. Go back a few generations in your own life. Who are you today? It's because of these generations that have brought you to this point. Now, let's go the other way. Future. If you know what the future is, if you have decided, and these are Tim Cook's words, this is interesting. I specifically wanted to emphasize these words. When you decide what the future is, you want to get there as soon as you can. Well, whose hands is the future in? Nobody but yourself. You decide what it is. In fact, if you get a chance, probably by the time this podcast comes out, our new AC101 is going to be out. This week I did it on superstitions, on, you know, things like the evil eye and reading coffee cups. Yeah, that's a big one in Armenian community. Read the coffee cups. You know, somehow the way the coffee powder dries, I'm laughing because that's what it is. I mean, there's people who take this seriously. I'm sorry, excuse me. Somehow the way the coffee powder dries, it determines what your life is going to be like, what you're going to do in your life. There you go. That's a good one, right? The coffee powder. Well, tea leaves, stars, all kinds of stuff. But what it does is it negates the power that you have. The individual power that you have to be able to create your destiny, to create your tomorrow. And that's why these words are very beautiful. When you decide what the future is, you want to get there as soon as you can. Well, definitely in technology, that has to be a mantra, right? In technology, that has to be the mantra, because technology doesn't wait. It's moving forward. Technology, I'm not talking about what's in your pocket in this cell phone or what's on your desk as a computer. Technology has been there from the beginning of time. And if you think about it, it's been the church up until now, up until this last couple hundred years, who has really pushed technology. In fact, why do we have books? Why was the printing press? Because of the needs of the church. Why do we think about art? Think about even stained glass, the use of different materials. They were developed, right, to pass along the information that the church had. Well, in the last couple hundred years, you know, since the Industrial Revolution, right? We see that different things are important. In fact, I can't remember if this was a Joseph Campbell statement or someone else said it, but you basically can see what's important in a society by the tallest building in a particular community. So whereas in days of old, the highest building in a particular town might be the church, the highest spire. So you're pointing to God. That's what was important. Then came the kingdoms. And what was the highest building? Was the castle. You'd look at the castle. Well, think about right now. Go into any city center. What is the highest building? Chase Manhattan. New York Life. Korean Air. Just last week became the largest here in Los Angeles. Basically, it's these financial institutions and the means to get to those financial institutions, basically big business. There it is. It's the same structure. That's what's important today. Okay, so Tim Cook says this statement, if you know what the future is, and you decide what the future is, you want to get there as soon as possible. Well, definitely technology is going to do that. But what about us? And this is this big preface I give you, because where are we? We are the church. You basically have this beautiful message of love, of hope, of faith, of bringing people together, of kneading the dough, of putting people together, putting different elements together and creating this beautiful, beautiful structure called life. But what do? As religion, we don't go for the excellence. We go for mediocrity. We go for the worst of the worst. And this is a sad commentary, because we don't believe in it ourselves. We do not believe in the power of God ourselves. We believe in the power of humankind. And we've excluded that extra natural, that supernatural from our lives because we can't understand it. Have you ever seen the savant syndrome? You know what? I'll make a note. That'll be on our today's show notes as well. My sister sent me a clip. I had shared this with you a couple of years ago when we had seen a small demonstration. Savants are people who just amazingly do stuff. And this particular clip that I'll make sure that it's on today's show notes, it's of Leslie, I forgot her last name, Channel 2. She was interviewing for 60 Minutes, a savant syndrome gentleman who basically walked into a room, sat at a piano and played Beethoven's Fifth Concerto, or whatever the tune might have been, from beginning to end. Now, here's the interesting thing. Severely, severely mentally challenged, this man. You ask him simple questions, what's 2 plus 3, and he's having a rough time to give you the answer. Not only that, he's blind, so his senses are muted. And yet he sits down and this beautiful creation comes out of him. It's unbelievable. Now you look at that and then you say, whoa, I do not understand that. And you know what? Science tries to understand it. That's beautiful. We should try to understand it. It is a mystery. I would like to know how that's done. I would like to know what's going on in there. But it does point to something beyond our senses. It does point to something beyond our understanding. And that's okay. That's okay. That's the beginning of all religious thought, or at least where it should be. That wonder that's out there, what Einstein called that wonder That looking out there is the beginning of all religiosity. And that wonders in life. It's a beautiful life. We complicate it by going for mediocrity. Go for excellence. If you know what the future is, if you've decided what the future is, why wouldn't you want to be there? Be there. There's a beautiful life in front of us. And this is not something about an escapism, because really living in the past is the ultimate escapism. But living for today, moving toward the future, is the direction that we're all called to do. And so over and over, Christ and his commandments tells us, it's not about calling out my name. It's not about saying, I love you. But it's about doing what we are called to do. Helping those in need. Caring for others. I've decided that that's the future. The future has to be a harmonious planet. The future has to be a place of peace. Therefore, why wouldn't I want to be there right now? And the only way that I can do it is with God's help to be able to implement those things that will bring about peace, namely justice, namely economic stability in some of these lands. And actually, what a segue. Second portion, we're going to be talking about a young lady who's on her way to Uganda to do some of that work. So let me take a break right now. We listen to a song of the day every week. Should call it Song of the Week, I guess. Yes. And so I've picked out a very special one for you today. And it'll probably make sense toward the end of today's show. But here it is. A little Conwen music. Yeah, some classical stuff. Enjoy. Thank you. Wild, isn't it? That is called Trabzon Bar. Trabzon is one of the areas of Armenia, one of the towns. And the dance of that town, that is off of an album called Music of Armenia. It's actually a 6-album set. I got it many, many years ago. I don't even know if it's still available. But if it is, definitely we will have a link on today's show notes to it. So do check it out. Trabzon Bar, Music of Armenia. And the featured instrument on there is the kanun. Beautiful lap harp, plucked. Yes, finger plucked. Different from the santur, which is done with the hammers. More like the dulcimer. But this is plucked by hands, and a fascinating instrument. Beautifully played. I hope you enjoyed it. I've got an interview for you today, an interview with Digrana Zakarian, a name you probably remember from last year when we were engaged in the 100th anniversary of the Armenian Genocide, but more recently she had joined the project development team over at the Armenian American Museum in Glendale. Yeah, that's just coming up. They're putting it up. And I want to just read to you a little thing that, a quote that she had said back then, and you'll figure out why I wanted to have this conversation and why I'm so glad to feature her today. She says, "I identify with the mission of the museum both personally and professionally in providing an educational space for Armenians and non-Armenians to come together and reflect on deeper issues of both history and contemporary issues, as well as tolerance and interconnectivity." Did I need to say any more? Just needed to say that one little word, interconnectivity. A lady who connects the dots on a big scale. She's on her way to Uganda. She's going to be there for about the next 9 months doing some incredible work. And I caught up with her early this morning. We had a cup of coffee at a very, very noisy Starbucks. I'd only say that just to prepare you for the extra. So if you can, filter out some of it. But a fascinating lady who pierces through some of that noise in many ways, metaphorically as well, and gets to the gist of the situation. Here is a conversation with Digrana Zakarian. Okay, so we're sitting at Starbucks with Digrana and had a chance to work with her last year, was it, in 2015. That big old year, 2015, 100 years, we did some Voices of Survivors event. I'm so glad that I am able to catch up with you before you go to...
To Uganda this Sunday.
Oh, wow, and you're going to Uganda for... I hear 9 months, right?
9 months.
Tell us about that, the Fulbright.
Yes, so I received a Fulbright fellowship through the U.S. State Department, and as I shared with you, it's been 5 years in the making in terms of contemplating making the move, going to Uganda, applying for the funding, and reapplying for the funding. I actually wasn't selected once, so the premise is... contemporary refugee research, so focusing on forced migrants specifically from the Democratic Republic of Congo. I'll be working in Uganda and examining Ugandan national policies as it pertains to its refugee population, and specifically for Congolese refugees residing in Uganda, focusing on those that are multi-generational refugees and also those that have recently fled the eastern provinces of the DRC, what local integration would look like for them. In terms of durable solutions for refugees, the international community defines it as repatriation to the refugee's country of origin, local integration into the country which they fled, and resettlement into a third-party country. Well, for refugees worldwide, we're about 60 million individuals that are currently displaced. Resettlement happens at a 1% rate, and we're talking all across the board. So what does that mean for a group of Congolese refugees in Central Africa? Yeah. It means that they're not being resettled, especially now where all of the world's resources are focused on the Middle East, focused on Syria, and focused on what's happening in Europe. That's created the shift of getting these issues into the news, but The reality is countries like Uganda, Kenya, Rwanda, and the Great Lakes region of Africa, they have had forced migration determine their internal and regional politics for generations now.
Mm-hmm.
And specifically in the case of Congolese refugees, it's actually, when I say generations, I mean about slightly over 20 years. It's very recent, and it stems from the 1994 Rwandan genocide. When it was pushed into the Congolese border, it created this shift where Congolese Tutsi refugees specifically started to be targeted,
mm-hmm.
because there's cross-border dynamics in terms of nationality and ethnicity, and that entire region of the Democratic Republic of Congo continues to be targeted by manipulated ethnicities, land disputes, and it's very wealthy in terms of its natural resources and its minerals. So all of that happens at the expense of the population that continue to flee.
Now you're going into Uganda, and Uganda has this history of accepting refugees. This is not the first population that's come in. I mean, you're looking at hundreds of years, right? Or at least the last 100 years, how many different communities have been displaced and enter. So what is the secret? What is it about Uganda that makes them so conducive for refugees?
Well, one can look at the map and look at where they are geographically. So the internal politics of Uganda, it's all determined by its geopolitical situation.
Mm-hmm.
So you have the Democratic Republic on one side, to the west. You have Rwanda to the south of the country. Then you have Sudan and South Sudan to the north. And then on the other side, you have Tanzania, Kenya, and then you receive a lot of Somali refugees. Right now, what's happening in the Central African Republic. So it's a tiny country in the middle. They call it the Pearl of Africa, actually.
Mm-hmm.
And within the Great Lakes region, there's constantly migration patterns happening.
Mm-hmm.
We call it forced cross-border migration. So it's not necessarily a choice in many respects.
Nice.
It's not like the United States, where we have our neighbor to the north being Canada and then our neighbor to the south being Mexico. The U.S. has its own dynamic. We've all been seeing in the news what's happening to Central American migrants, mainly youth. But it's very different, you know. We're geographically isolated, whereas Uganda is not.
Right.
So the refugee settlement reality is something that's characterized at least the past 50 to 60 years of Uganda.
Okay, so in Uganda you have these refugees. Let's connect some dots now for us, okay? Because basically, as an Armenian population, we are a refugee community, whether it's been 100 years. I mean, prior to 100 years ago, the Armenian diaspora was defined by a couple communities. Now we're all over the world. What implications? Do you hope to find any implications for the Armenian community by studying a population that's so close to their being refugee? Or in Rwanda's case, they're 20 years out of a genocide. That's like looking at Armenia 1930s.
Yes.
Do you find that there could be a connection there, or are you looking for one?
So let's look at the Armenian diaspora.
Yeah.
Everyone has their own perspective in terms of what a sense of belonging means, but the Armenian diaspora, the reason that it's so vibrant is because we uphold the fact that we're Armenian. So whether you're Armenian American or you're Armenian from Latin America, Argentina, Brazil, Venezuela, they all have huge communities there. Whether you're from France, Canada, or countries in the Middle East, whether you're Armenian from Turkey, from your ancestral lands, we all, one way or another, identify in being Armenian. And for everyone, that's a different sense of belonging, as I mentioned, but also a different sense of mission.
Mm-hmm.
And for me, that's really shaped my aspirations in terms of how I connect to other human beings. And we can't remain in a bubble. We can't continue to educate ourselves on what being Armenian means, because the genocide is a sad reality of one part of our history. Prior to that, we have another cultural history that stems hundreds of years, Armenians being some of the oldest inhabitants to this,
yes,
to this planet. But you can't teach that forward to other communities and bridge those gaps and build those bridges by teaching other Armenians and your local community only about the Armenian genocide. And what is more powerful and what puts you in a position to do this kind of work than to connect with other communities that continue to be affected? Mm-hmm. That's the reality, is we teach people, we always say it's the first genocide of the 20th century. Well, what does the first genocide mean? It means that several other genocides have occurred throughout different continents, throughout different peoples, and it continues to occur. And the sad reality is, the part of the world I'm going to, that's just it. It's a reality. But the world has looked away, and yet we as a community burn so much energy teaching the world. Well, the world knows. But how do we move forward?
Yeah.
How do we actually continue to not only teach, but advocate for those that continue to be affected? And the thing is, you don't just go into a community and go in as this expert. No, not in any way. You go in trying to relate to people. And you can't just start taking information from people. When I go to Uganda, I'm going to be so immersed in culture, in knowledge, in people sharing their experiences. But what do I have to share?
Mm-hmm.
To many, I'll be an American. But I'm not just an American. I'm an Armenian American that's shaped by my own experiences. And I can only be relatable if I teach about myself. Mm-hmm. And that's how the world will learn about Armenians.
Right. So just for our listeners, we go back. I mean, I talked about it back then, but the way you and I connected, you put together this beautiful opportunity to talk about genocide exactly in the terms you described. So I was one of a few panelists, if I remember right. There was a couple from the Holocaust, which are easy to find still, Holocaust survivors. And there was from Rwandan genocide. I can't remember the other, but there was like four or five of us on the panel, right?
So last year, marking the centennial of the Armenian Genocide, it was a commemorative year, and specifically the month of April is a commemorative year for various communities have been affected by genocide. So why 2015 was significant was because it marked the centennial of the Armenian Genocide, but it was the 70th anniversary of the European Holocaust. It was the 40th anniversary of the Cambodian genocide. It was the 21st anniversary of the Rwandan genocide. And April of 2015 marked the 20th anniversary of the start of the Bosnian War, which that July marked the Bosnian genocide,
right,
the Srebrenica genocide. So there was a lot of commemoration happening within the Armenian community, and Los Angeles being so expansive and wide, there were commemorative activities happening all over the city for the different respective communities. So the idea was bring panelists, survivors, those who have firsthand accounts of what genocide actually means, not through a theoretic or academic perspective, but an actual lived perspective experience, and bring them together and host a very organic conversation. So you being one of the panelists, everyone that met, it was the first time everyone met. So as the facilitator, that was very nerve-wracking in the sense of how the audience would perceive the panelists. Would they be respectful? Would they really honor and cherish the moment that they have a group of individuals to really talk about what genocide is in front of them? And then how would the panelists react to each other's stories? And
right.
The beautiful moment for me was to see everyone that was in that room on a Saturday afternoon to learn about genocide. I mean, Father Boston, you might remember, it was standing room only.
Yes, I do remember. What a thing on Southern California Saturday. You're going to go in. Yeah.
And it wasn't, I mean, maybe the Armenians in the room were 30% of the, you had.
I don't think that much. Yeah,
maybe
I think
not even that much. You had individuals that traveled as far as Long Beach to be in Glendale that day because they had a Cambodian panelist.
Right, speaking. Cambodian, yes.
And for the panelists themselves, everyone built on each other's stories. So they filled in the gaps between what was being shared. So you had someone as old as 92 years old, I should say as young as 92 years old, Renee Firestone, who's an Auschwitz survivor. And then you have someone as young as Yulia, who's from Bosnia. She's a Serbian refugee from Bosnia, 30 years old, educator, working in Los Angeles.
Right.
You know? And then you had yourself speaking on behalf of not only the Armenian community, but your grandparents.
Yeah. And I always, you mentioned earlier about the first genocide, I always feel so special in my life that I was able to go to Rwanda in 2006 and basically had a foot on the first and last genocides of the 20th century. And so, like, in between those 2 feet, you see this huge tragedy of humanity. And why aren't we talking about those things? So you said something earlier. You said you were feared. I don't know if that was the right word. You said something about would the audience be respectful of the other speakers? What was your hesitation there? I'm interested to know. Why did you think that they would be disrespectful?
I think a natural worry in the sense of you're really opening people up in a public setting to being vulnerable. Mm. And would they be respectful of the panelists in the sense of give them their full attention? So things like being on your cell phone, even to me, would be a sign of neglect and disrespect, or really trying to commoditize the situation by taking too many, the etiquette of being there. It was a very sacred space. It had to be a safe space all around. So even, it was in an art gallery setting,
right?
But we didn't even have a stage or anything, because you had to be very careful that you're not putting the panelists or survivors on a stage, on a pedestal in any way. It needed to be ground level, eye level with everyone involved.
So this was all thought out, huh?
This all had to be thought out. Wow. When you're doing something as delicate as that. You know, these are the things I as the organizer think about, and I consulted with a lot of people, you know, that gave me advice and had experience on doing this. The USC Shoah Foundation, for instance, this is what they do. They do oral histories, and so I consulted with them, for instance. The Los Angeles Museum of the Holocaust and the Righteous Conversations Project, they connected me with both Harry Davids, and Renee Firestone, who wanted to be panelists. And so you have Renee, who's an Auschwitz survivor, and then you have Harry, who was a child. Mm. And so he really brought the reality of my survival was based on other people being upstanders, if you recall him mentioning that.
Right, yes,
you know,
yes.
He was 5 years old.
Right.
And so when I go back and I talk about that vulnerability, it's would the audience hear and actually get the message?
Mm.
And would the panelists be empowered by sharing their experiences, or they can equally be traumatized, re-traumatized?
It's interesting that all these dimensions were accounted for. Tell me a little bit about the personal, because we talked about this earlier, about why you're in it. Considering that we're in a world right now that is run by really screwy politics, I mean, you're doing this incredible work. We look at Africa. We look at, go back to the early Chacha trials. And, I mean, you've got communities coming together trying to get over some of these horrific acts of genocide. I mean, to me, the genocide is the ultimate. You know, there's no explanation for it except pure hatred manifested. Communities, you going out there, leaving the comforts of America, going out to Uganda, trying to get all this stuff. And then you got some screwball. Some guy in North Korea who says, hey, I'm going to fire a missile out at the U.S. Or you've got, let's not go far. You got a Donald Trump out there that says, hey, we got to do this and that. And how do you reconcile the work you're doing with the state of the world in general, and especially with politics?
Well, I think everything at its core begins on a community level.
Mm-hmm.
So people are going to be very prone to being divided when there's no unification to begin with. When people don't know who their neighbors are, when they have no one-on-one relationship with those around them, and that culture, that energy already exists, it's going to be very easy for someone like a Donald Trump, let's just stay within our own you know, national politics, to come in and divide those communities. Because what is his message? His message has been fear.
Mm-hmm.
All along.
Yes.
It has, and it's been, the reason why he has mobilized is because he uses dinner table politics. He's able to simplify that hatred on a very, very basic level.
Right, right.
And therefore it's appealing to people who are not able to really articulate why they are feeling what they're feeling. So instead of realizing that it's fear, actually, it just turns into hatred. And that's where people are easily manipulated. So when we talk about a horrible atrocity, like genocide, just a complete disgrace to what it means to be human, we don't have to look far in terms of how that discrimination starts. And it's because someone is able to mobilize in that respect. So going back to the work I'll be doing in Uganda, local integration, it's not that a refugee just picks up, leaves a settlement, and integrates into a community. There's a lot of social and economic tensions that are going to play out with that community they're integrating to, because they're competing for the same socioeconomic resources. And so there's that perception, and again, we're speaking in Uganda, that a refugee that's living off of handouts, that does not have any kind of means of taking care of themselves without receiving international aid. They receive land, food handouts, supplements. They're coming in and they're competing for the same resources. Well, that in and of itself, you have a problem there, right? And so you see that in the U.S. when we have immigrants coming in, and we just describe it differently. We say they're taking our jobs. They're doing this. They're not American enough. But actually, all of this, just it's the same exact thing. It's just in a different part of the world, and we just describe it differently. So that's what we need to tap into. It's like, what is it inherent within each of us, even myself, you know, where we see regular civilians that then become perpetrators of genocide, or they succumb to that hatred? What is it within ourselves that we're lacking? What is it, that shift that hasn't happened yet in our own human evolution, that we're able to fall into these patterns?
Let's talk a little bit about you personally doing this. What do you see at the end of all of this? Is there any hope? Is there a hope that by doing these kind of things, connecting the dots between these communities, we can stop genocide? Because ultimately, why are we doing any of this? Why are we getting the word? Why are you creating? By the way, Degrana was responsible for, was working with the Armenian American Museum here in Glendale, a very big project. I mean, when you think about its ramifications and ability to bring people together, obviously there's a reason we're doing it. It's not just to put up a flag that, hey, we're the first genocide, but to stop genocide, right?
Stop genocide.
So what do you personally see? Is there hope?
I like to consider myself an optimist that keeps her feet on the ground. So I believe it's important to be optimistic, but I would not call myself an idealist.
Okay.
So I think that you need to take steps, and if you at some point I had to make the decision that I don't have a choice. What the alternative would be to not do anything would be, if I have made this my area of focus in terms of genocide prevention and actually providing livelihoods for refugee populations, those that are affected by ethnic cleansing within these themes, the alternative would be to maybe just be an academic, just to theorize, and I think academia is very important with all respect, but the alternative would be to accept that these realities are happening and that we can't do anything about it. Well, the biggest challenge is to envision what we don't have yet, which is a world without genocide. That's the challenge. So when you can really make that transition of, okay, if I don't try, if I don't build coalitions, if I don't work with other individuals that are already in this field, if I don't put myself out there to be disappointed and to be vulnerable and to be really hurt by humanity, actually, you know, it's a lot, it's very taxing on yourself as well. if you make that sacrifice, if you accept, and that's where the optimism isn't there, right? That's where you're a realist. Then you're able to actually move forward. Because what's happening is those that are affected by ongoing genocides, by displacement, they don't have a choice. So we, as those that are very privileged, as Armenian Americans now that are 101 years removed from the genocide, survivors in our history, we have that privilege now to give back. But it's not just a privilege. That's the thing. It is very much a moral obligation. And if maybe it's not you or I, but maybe it's other Armenian Americans that, you know, they have 9-to-5 jobs and whatever it is, and they have their lives that they are focused on, that's all respectable and it's great. But Make sure on a day-to-day basis you're doing whatever you can to extend kindness to strangers. That positivity, because it is contagious.
Yes.
I do believe it's a cause and effect. So you're going to receive exactly what you're putting out there, and vice versa. Your energy, your actions, we can't operate in a bubble. So it absolutely has an immediate effect on your immediate environment. And that's the shift. Again, we're talking about the shift. That's what we need to make. It's living as conscious beings. Because it will change. You know, so when you have someone like a Donald Trump coming in, but you are emitting this positivity, you're constantly at least trying to develop yourself. So don't be fake about it. Let's be frank. But constantly trying to develop yourself as a human being, that's going to have a ripple effect on those around you.
So, in conclusion, I do know some personal stuff about you. Sitar, are you still playing?
So, I had my last sitar lesson last Friday. And I am still playing, but it's on hold at the moment. A sitar is a very delicate instrument.
Is it going with you to Rwanda?
And it's not going with me. It's just a very big risk to travel with. Even from my home in Glendale to Pasadena, transporting it, I have to be very careful with the way I place it into a car. So perhaps if my life becomes slightly more settled, even in that respective part of the world, it will come with me. But as my amazing sitar teacher, Don Kirby, says, nothing is ever lost. So I'm taking a break, but that doesn't mean that
the information
is gone.
I hope it doesn't get lost. All I could do is wish you all the best in your travels and in your work, and I look forward maybe in 9 months when you get back sitting down again. And hopefully in a little quieter place than this horrible... by the way, we're at a Starbucks that doesn't have any walls, and there are buses, and I think our listeners heard all kinds of buses and motorcycles, everything else going by. But it was certainly a pleasure being here. Thank you for making the time.
Thank you, Father Vosgen, and I hope we can collaborate on more projects down the line. So I wish you all the best.
Thank you. I hope so. Conversation with Digrana Zakharyan. I hope you enjoyed it. Despite some of the noise in the background too, not just some, but a lot, but giving us a lot of food for thought. I'll have some links on today's show notes so you could check out some of the other work that she's been engaged in, and we wish her all the best. Offline, we talked about possibility of a blog. If she does put together something, I'll be happy to share it with you. In the meantime, do check out today's show notes. And I do make you a bigger promise, too, that the next time she comes on the show, we will definitely bring her into the studio. None of this, what was that, a Starbucks without walls? I didn't realize how noisy it was till Ken shared his headphones with me. Holy moly. Anyway, it'll get better. But we wish her all the best and thank her immensely for joining us. Right now, I'm going to let Susie make her announcements. We'll be back in a couple moments.
Susie here again. Before continuing with today's broadcast, I'd like to take this opportunity to remind you that this podcast is made possible through your prayers and generous donations. We are now in the 9th year of producing shows which are heard around the globe. Since 2008, we've provided quality programming through podcasts, educational videos, and streams, using technology's most current resources. The message of Armenian Orthodoxy, or as Father Vosgen calls it, Armadoxy, is giving people an intelligent and practical answer to many of life's difficulties, including the challenge to bring peace to a hurting world. Please take a moment now to visit inhisshoes.org and press on the donate button. Your encouragement goes a long way. Thanks for listening and God bless. We now return to this week's Next Step with Father Vosgen.
Thank you, Susie, for that reminder. And a reminder to all of you that today's show is being sponsored by Predator Cycling, specializing in custom carbon bicycles, components, accessories, and repair. Predator Cycling, pushing the limits of technology. Oh, you can't get any better than that, right? Isn't that what we've been talking about today? Pushing the limits of technology, derived from experience, created from passion, fabricated by cyclists for cyclists. Predator Cycling. Visit them. predatorcycling.com. And today's show is also sponsored by all of your generosity, everyone who participates in this program, through your contributions, through just taking the link and sharing it with friends. I'm always amazed. I've been in Seattle last week. I'm going to be up there for the next couple weeks for services. Always interesting to find people who come up and say, hey, we've been listening to your show. Sometimes people, I wish they weren't listening to the show. They know a little bit too much, but that's kind of fun too. But I've been meeting so many people from just the wildest places. So I do really appreciate you passing along the links to people, telling people about it. And do visit us at the mothership inissues.org, where you'll find all of our podcasts and you'll find most of it, most everything that we do. Also, from the beginning of time, everything is archived on epostle.net. And we're going through, you know, quite a bit of stuff right now, trying to organize everything. A lot of meetings, but you know what? These are fruitful because at the end, good stuff is happening out of this. So that brings me to the last thank you. Thank you for your prayers. It's those prayers that keep pushing us and get us moving and headed in the right direction. So thank you very much for partnering with us on this exciting electronic ministry. Yeah, most electronic stuff is exciting. Well, because that's the definition of electronic, right? Electrons just racing around, excited, moving around. Yeah. Okay, before I get myself into any trouble, let me say thank you for joining us. I hope you enjoyed today's show as much as we enjoyed producing it for you. Catch us at all the usual spots, the ones I told you about, as well as Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. Do the following, do the sharing. Do it all, okay? A very special best wishes to Tigrana as she heads out to Uganda, wishing her a safe and fruitful trip. Looking forward to seeing her in 9 months and hearing all of the adventures. God be with you, Tigrana. And as for the rest of you, if you happen to be in Seattle, do catch me. I'll be at the Holy Resurrection Church this Sunday. And if you're not in Seattle, hey, join us again next week. On behalf of Susie, our producer, Ken, our engineer, this is Father Boskin inviting you to join us again next week when we will take the next step.
And now here's the fine print.
The information and comments presented within this podcast and our website do not necessarily represent the views of the Armenian Church hierarchy, but are presented as a challenge to define the dynamics of Armenian Orthodoxy in all aspects of life. Listening to these shows is habit-forming. Addictive behavior associated with the next step is rarely, if ever, remedied. Rather, the next step is known to relieve and cure common cases of narrow-mindedness, prejudice, numbskulledness, and glaucoma in patients over the age of 20. Results may vary depending on credit rating. Findings are based on double-blind studies conducted in Istanbul and Jerusalem. Side effects include mind expansion, clarity of focus, higher rates of heart palpitations, sensitivity to the pain of others, and occasional nausea. The management and production crew of epostle.net take full responsibility for changes you will experience. Not valid with any other offer.
Off power. On top limits.